This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Blindsided by Karen Slaughter. Performed by Kathleen Early. Monday. Chapter 1. Sarah Linton leaned back in her chair, mumbling a soft, "Yes, Mama," into the telephone. She wondered briefly if there would ever come a point in time when she would be too old to be taken over her mother's knee. "Yes, Mama," she repeated, tapping her pen on the desk. She felt heat coming off her cheeks, and an overwhelming sense of embarrassment took hold. A soft knock came at the office door, followed by a tentative, "Dr. Linton?" Sarah suppressed her relief. "I need to go," she said to her mother, who shot off one last admonishment before hanging up the phone. Nellie Morgan slid open the door, giving Sarah a hard look. As office manager for the Hartsdale Children's Clinic, Nellie was the closest thing Sarah had to a secretary. Nellie had been running the place for as long as Sarah could remember, even as far back as when Sarah was herself a patient here. Nellie said, "Your cheeks are on fire." "I just got yelled at by my mother." Nellie raised an eyebrow. "I assume with good reason." "Well," Sarah said, hoping that would end it. "The labs on Jimmy Powell came in," Nellie said, still eyeing Sarah. "And the mail," she added, dropping a stack of letters on top of the in-basket. The plastic bowed under the added weight. Sarah sighed as she read over the facts. On a good day, she diagnosed earaches and sore throats. Today, she would have to tell the parents of a 12-year-old boy that he had acute myoblastic leukemia. "Not good," Nellie guessed. She had worked at the clinic long enough to know how to read a lab report. "No," Sarah agreed, rubbing her eyes. "Not good at all." She sat back in her chair, asking, "The Powells are at Disney World, right?" "For his birthday," Nellie said. "They should be back tonight." Sarah felt a sadness come over her. She had never gotten used to delivering this kind of news. Nellie offered, "I can schedule them for first thing in the morning." "Thanks," Sarah answered, tucking the report into Jimmy Powell's chart. She glanced at the clock on the wall as she did this and let out an audible gasp. "Is that right?" she asked, checking the time against her watch. "I was supposed to meet Tessa at lunch 15 minutes ago." Nellie checked her own watch. "This late in the day? It's closer to supper time." "It was the only time I could make it," Sarah said, gathering charts together. She bumped the inbox and papers fell onto the floor in a heap, cracking the plastic tray. "Crap," Sarah hissed. Nellie started to help, but Sarah stopped her. Aside from the fact that Sarah did not like other people cleaning up her messes, if Nellie somehow managed to get down on her knees, it was doubtful she would be able to get back up without considerable assistance. "I've got it," Sarah told her, scooping up the whole pile and dropping it on her desk. "Was there anything else?" Nellie flashed a smile. "Chief Tolliver's holding on line 3. Sarah sat back on her heels, a feeling of dread washing over her. She did double duty as the town's pediatrician and coroner. Jeffrey Tolliver, her ex-husband, was the chief of police. There were only 2 reasons for him to be calling Sarah in the middle of the day, neither of them particularly pleasant. Sarah stood and picked up the phone, giving him the benefit of the doubt. "Somebody better be dead." Jeffrey's voice was garbled, and she assumed he was using his cellular phone.
"Sorry to disappoint you," he said. Then, "I've been on hold for 10 minutes. What if this had been an emergency?"
She started shoving papers into her briefcase. It was an unwritten clinic policy to make Jeffrey jump through hoops of fire before he could speak to Sarah on the telephone. She was actually surprised that Nellie remembered to tell Sarah he was on the phone.
"Sarah?"
She glanced at the door, mumbling, "I knew I should have just left."
"What?"
he asked, his voice echoing slightly on the cellular.
I said you always send someone if it's an emergency, she lied. Where are you?
At the college, he answered. I'm waiting for the deputy dogs. He was using their term for the campus security at Grant Tech, the state university at the center of town. She asked, What is it?
I just wanted to see how you were doing.
Fine, she snapped, pulling the papers back out of her briefcase, wondering why she had put them there in the first place. She flipped through some charts, shoving them into the side pocket. She said, I'm late for lunch with Tess. What did you need?
He seemed taken aback by her curt tone. You just looked distracted yesterday, he said. In church.
I wasn't distracted, she mumbled, flipping through the mail. She stopped at the sight of a postcard, her whole body going rigid. The front of the card showed a picture of Emory University in Atlanta, Sarah's alma mater. Neatly typed on the back beside her address at the children's clinic were the words, Why hast thou forsaken me?
Sarah?
A cold sweat came over her. I need to go.
Sarah, I...
She hung up the phone before Jeffrey could finish his sentence, shoving three more charts into her briefcase along with the postcard. She slipped out the side door without anyone seeing her. Sunlight beamed down on Sarah as she walked into the street. There was a chill in the air that had not been there this morning, and the dark clouds promised rain later on tonight. A red thunderbird passed, a small arm hanging out the window.
Hey, Dr. Linton,
a child called. Sarah waved, calling, Hey, back as she crossed the street. Sarah switched the briefcase from one hand to the other as she cut across the lawn in front of the college. She took a right onto the sidewalk, heading toward Main Street, and was at the diner in less than 5 minutes. Tessa was sitting in a booth on the far wall of the empty diner, eating a hamburger. She did not look pleased. Sorry I'm late, Sarah offered, walking toward her sister. She tried a smile, but Tessa did not respond in kind.
You said 2. It's nearly 2:30.
I had paperwork, Sarah explained, tucking her briefcase into the booth. Tessa was a plumber, like their father. While clogged drains were no laughing matter, very seldom did Linton and daughters get the kind of emergency phone calls that Sarah did on a daily basis. Her family could not grasp what a busy day was like for Sarah and were constantly irritated by her lateness. I called the morgue at 2, Tessa informed her, nibbling a French fry. You weren't there. Sarah sat down with a groan, running her fingers through her hair. I dropped back by the clinic and Mama called and the time got away from me. She stopped, saying what she always said. I'm sorry, I should have called. When Tessa did not respond, Sarah continued, You can keep being mad at me for the rest of lunch, or you can drop it, and I'll buy you a slice of chocolate cream pie.
Red velvet, Tessa countered.
Deal, Sarah returned, feeling an inordinate sense of relief. It was bad enough having her mother mad at her. Speaking of calls, Tessa began, and Sarah knew where she was going even before she asked the question. Hear from Jeffrey? Sarah raised up, tucking her hand into her front pocket. She pulled out 2 $5 bills. He called before I left the clinic. Tessa barked a laugh that filled the restaurant.
What did he say?
I cut him off before he could say anything, Sarah answered, handing her sister the money. Tessa tucked the 5s into the back pocket of her blue jeans. So, Mama called? She was pretty pissed at you.
I'm pretty pissed at me, too, Sarah said. After being divorced for 2 years, she still could not let go of her ex-husband.
Sarah vacillated between hating Jeffrey Tolliver and hating herself because of this. She wanted just one day to go by without thinking about him, without having him in her life. Yesterday, much like today, had not been that day. Easter Sunday was important to her mother. While Sarah was not particularly religious, putting on pantyhose one Sunday out of the year was a small price to pay for Kathy Linton's happiness. Sarah had not planned on Jeffrey being at church. She had caught him out of the corner of her eye just after the first hymn. He was sitting three rows behind and to the right of her, and they seemed to notice each other at the same time. Sarah had forced herself to look away first. Sitting there in church, staring at the preacher without hearing a word the man was saying, Sarah had felt Jeffrey's gaze on the back of her neck. There was a heat from the intensity of his stare that caused a warm flush to come over her. Despite the fact that she was sitting in church with her mother on one side of her and Tessa and her father on the other, Sarah had felt her body responding to the look Jeffrey had given her. There was something about this time of year that turned her into a completely different person. She was actually fidgeting in her seat, thinking about Jeffrey touching her, the way his hands felt on her skin, when Kathy Linton jabbed her elbow into Sarah's ribs. Her mother's expression said she knew exactly what was going through Sarah's mind at that moment and did not like it one bit. Kathy had crossed her arms angrily, her posture indicating she was resigning herself to the fact that Sarah would go to hell for thinking about sex at the Primitive Baptist on Easter Sunday. There was a prayer, then another hymn. After what seemed like an appropriate amount of time, Sarah glanced over her shoulder to find Jeffrey again, only to see him with his head bent down to his chest as he slept. This was the problem with Jeffrey Tolliver. The idea of him was much better than the reality. Tessa tapped her fingers on the table for Sarah's attention. Sarah! Sarah put her hand to her chest, conscious that her heart was pounding the same way it had yesterday morning in church. What? Tessa gave her a knowing look, but thankfully did not pursue it. What did Jeb say?
What do you mean?
I saw you talking to him after the service, Tessa said. What did he say? Sarah debated whether or not to lie. Finally, she answered, He asked me out for lunch today, but I told him I was seeing you.
You could have canceled.
Sarah shrugged. We're going out Wednesday night. Tessa did everything but clap her hands together. God, Sarah groaned. What was I thinking?
Not about Jeffrey for a change, Tessa answered. Right?
Sarah took the menu from behind the napkin holder, though she hardly needed to look at it. She or some member of her family had eaten at the Grant filling station at least once a week since Sarah was 3 years old, and the only change to the menu in all that time had been when Pete Wayne, the owner, had added peanut brittle to the dessert menu in honor of then-President Jimmy Carter. Tessa reached across the table, gently pushing down the menu.
You okay?
It's that time of year again, Sarah said, rummaging around in her briefcase. She found the postcard and held it up. Tessa did not take the card, so Sarah read aloud from the back.
Why hast thou forsaken me?
She put the card down on the table between them, waiting for Tessa's response.
From the Bible? Tessa asked, though surely she knew.
Sarah looked out the window, trying to compose herself. Suddenly, she stood up from the table, saying, I need to go wash my hands.
Sarah?
She waved off Tessa's concern, walking to the back of the diner, trying to hold herself together until she reached the bathroom. The door to the women's room had stuck in the frame since the beginning of time, so Sarah gave the handle a hard yank. Inside, the small black-and-white tiled bathroom was cool and almost comforting. She leaned back against the wall, hands to her face, trying to wipe out the last few hours of her day. Jimmy Powell's lab results still haunted her. 12 years ago, while working her medical internship at Atlanta's Grady Hospital, Sarah had grown familiar with, if not accustomed to, death. Grady had the best ER in the Southeast, and Sarah had seen her share of difficult traumas. From a kid who had swallowed a pack of razor blades, to a teenage girl who had been given a clothes hanger abortion. These were horrible cases, but not altogether unexpected in such a large city. Cases like Jimmy Powell's coming through the children's clinic hit Sarah with the force of a wrecking ball. This would be one of the rare cases when Sarah's two jobs would converge. Jimmy Powell, who liked to watch college basketball and held one of the largest collections of Hot Wheels Sarah had personally ever seen, would more than likely be dead within the next year. Sarah clipped her hair back into a loose ponytail as she waited for the sink to fill with cold water. She leaned over the sink, pausing at the sickly sweet smell coming from the basin. Pete had probably dumped vinegar down the drain to keep it from smelling sour. It was an old plumber's trick, but Sarah hated the smell of vinegar. She held her breath as she leaned back over, splashing her face with water, trying to wake up. A glance back at the mirror showed nothing had improved, but a wet spot from the water was just below the neckline of her shirt. "Great," Sarah mumbled. She dried her hands on her pants as she walked toward the stalls. After seeing the contents of the toilet, she moved to the next stall, the handicap stall, and opened the door.
"Oh,"
Sarah breathed, stepping back quickly, only stopping when the sink basin pressed against the back of her legs. She put her hands behind her, bracing herself on the counter. A metallic taste came to her mouth, and Sarah forced herself to take in gulps of air so that she wouldn't pass out. She dropped her head down, closing her eyes, counting out a full 5 seconds before she looked up again. Sybil Adams, a professor at the college, sat on the toilet. Her head was tilted back against the tiled wall, her eyes closed. Her pants were pulled down around her ankles, legs splayed wide open. She had been stabbed in the abdomen. Blood filled the toilet between her legs, dripping onto the tiled floor. Sarah forced herself to move into the stall, crouching in front of the young woman. Sybil's shirt was pulled up, and Sarah could see a large, vertical cut down her abdomen, bisecting her navel and stopping at the pubic bone. Another cut, much deeper, slashed horizontally under her breasts. This was the source of most of the blood, and it still dripped in a steady stream down the body. Sarah put her hand to the wound, trying to halt the bleeding, but blood seeped between her fingers as if she were squeezing a sponge. Sarah wiped her hands on the front of her shirt, then tilted Sybil's head forward. A small moan escaped from the woman's lips, but Sarah could not tell if this was a simple release of air from a corpse or the plea of a living woman.
"Sybil?"
Sarah whispered, barely able to manage the word. Fear sat in the back of her throat like a summer cold.
"Sybil,"
she repeated, using her thumb to press open Sybil's eyelid. The woman's skin was hot to the touch, as if she had been out in the sun too long. A large bruise covered the right side of her face. Sarah could see the impression of a fist under the eye. Bone moved under Sarah's hand when she touched the bruise, clicking like two marbles rubbing together. Sarah's hand shook as she pressed her fingers against Sybil's carotid artery. A fluttering rose against her fingertips, but Sarah wasn't sure if it was the tremor in her own hands or life that she was feeling. Sarah closed her eyes, concentrating, trying to separate the two sensations. Without warning, the body jerked violently, pitching forward and slamming Sarah onto the floor. Blood spread out around both of them, and Sarah instinctively clawed to get out from under the convulsing woman. With her feet and hands, she groped for some kind of purchase on the slick bathroom floor. Finally, Sarah managed to slide out from underneath her. She turned Sybil over, cradling her head, trying to help her through the convulsions. Suddenly, the jerking stopped. Sarah put her ear to Sybil's mouth, trying to make out breathing sounds. There were none. Sitting up on her knees, Sarah started compressions, trying to push life back into Sybil's heart. Sarah pinched the younger woman's nose, breathing air into her mouth. Sybil's chest rose briefly, but nothing more. Sarah tried again, gagging as blood coughed up into her mouth. She spit several times to clear her mouth, prepared to continue, but she could tell it was too late. Sybil's eyes rolled back into her head, and her breath hissed out with a low shudder. A trickle of urine came from between her legs. She was dead. Chapter 2 Grant County was named for the good Grant, not Ulysses, but Lemuel Pratt Grant, a railroad builder who, in the mid-1800s, extended the Atlanta line deep into South Georgia and to the sea. It was on Grant's rails that trains carted cotton and other commodities all across Georgia. This rail line had put cities like Hartsdale, Madison, and Avondale on the map. And there were more than a few Georgia towns named after the man. At the start of the Civil War, Colonel Grant also developed a defense plan, should Atlanta ever come under siege. Unfortunately, he was better with railroad lines than front lines. During the Depression, the citizens of Avondale, Hartsdale, and Madison decided to combine their police and fire departments as well as their schools. This helped economize on much-needed services and helped persuade the railroads to keep the Grant Line open. The county was much larger as a whole than as individual cities. In 1928, an army base was built in Madison, bringing families from all over the nation to tiny Grant County. A few years later, Avondale became a stopping point for railroad maintenance on the Atlanta-Savannah line. A few more years passed, and Grant College sprang up in Hartsdale. For nearly 60 years, the county prospered, until base closings, consolidations, and Reaganomics trickled down, crushing the economies of Madison and Avondale within 3 years of each other. But for the college, which in 1946 became a technological university specializing in agribusiness, Hartsdale would have followed the same downward trend as its sister cities. As it was, the college was the lifeblood of the city, and Police Chief Jeffrey Tolliver's first directive from Hartsdale's mayor was to keep the college happy if he wanted to keep his job. Jeffrey was doing just that, meeting with the campus police, discussing a plan of action for a recent outbreak of bicycle thefts, when his cell phone rang. At first, he did not recognize Sarah's voice and thought the cell was some kind of prank. In the 8 years he had known her, Sarah had never sounded so desperate. Her voice trembled as she said three words he had never expected to come from her mouth. "I need you." Jeffrey took a left outside the college gates and drove his Lincoln Town Car up Main Street toward the diner. Spring was very early this year, and already the dogwood trees lining the street were blooming, weaving a white curtain over the road. The women from the garden club had planted tulips in the little planters lining the sidewalks, and a couple of kids from the high school were out sweeping the street instead of spending a week in after-school detention. The owner of the dress shop had put a rack of clothes on the sidewalk, and the hardware store had set up an outdoor gazebo display, complete with porch swing. Jeffrey knew the scene would be a sharp contrast to the one waiting for him at the diner. He rolled down the window, letting fresh air into the stuffy car. His tie felt tight against his throat, and he found himself taking it off without thinking. In his mind, he kept playing Sarah's phone call over and over in his head, trying to get more from it than the obvious facts. Sybil Adams had been stabbed and killed at the diner. 20 years as a cop had not prepared Jeffrey for this kind of news. Half of his career had been spent in Birmingham, Alabama, where murder seldom surprised. Not a week went by when he wasn't called out to investigate at least one homicide, usually a product of Birmingham's extreme poverty. Drug transactions gone wrong, domestic disputes where guns were too readily available. If Sarah's call had come from Madison or even Avondale, Jeffrey would not have been surprised. Drugs and gang violence were fast becoming a problem in the outlying towns. Hartsdale was the jewel of the three cities. In 10 years, the only suspicious fatality in Hartsdale involved an old woman who had a heart attack when she caught her grandson stealing her television.
Chief.
Jeffrey reached down, picking up his radio.
Yeah?
Marla Sims, the receptionist at the station house, said,
I've taken care of that thing you wanted.
Good, he answered. Then, radio silence until further notice.
Marla was quiet, not asking the obvious question. Grant was still a small town, and even in the station house there were people who would talk. Jeffrey wanted to keep a lid on this as long as possible.
Copy? Jeffrey asked.
Finally, she answered,
Yes, sir.
Jeffrey tucked his cell phone into his coat pocket as he got out of the car. Frank Wallace, his senior detective on the squad, was already standing sentry outside the door.
Anyone in or out? Jeffrey asked.
He shook his head.
Brad's on the back door, he said. The alarm's disconnected. I gotta think the perp used it for his in and out.
Jeffrey looked back at the street. Betty Reynolds, the owner of the Five and Dime, was out sweeping the sidewalk, casting suspicious glances at the diner. People would start walking over soon, if not out of curiosity, then for supper. Jeffrey turned back to Frank.
Nobody saw anything.
Not a thing, Frank confirmed. She walked here from her house. Pete says she comes here every Monday after the lunch rush.
Jeffrey managed a tight nod, walking into the diner. The Grant filling station was central to Main Street, with its big red booths and speckled white countertops, chrome rails and straw dispensers. It looked much as it probably had the day Pete's dad opened for business. Even the solid white linoleum tiles on the floor, so worn in spots the black adhesive showed through, were original to the restaurant. Jeffrey had eaten lunch here almost every day for the last 10 years. The diner had been a source of comfort, something familiar after working with the dregs of humanity. He looked around the open room, knowing it would never be the same for him again. Tessa Linton sat at the counter, her head in her hands. Pete Wayne sat opposite her, staring blindly out the window. Except for the day the space shuttle Challenger had exploded, this was the first time Jeffrey had ever seen him not wearing his paper hat inside the diner. Still, Pete's hair was bunched up into a point at the top, making his face look longer than it already was.
Tess?
Jeffrey asked, putting his hand on her shoulder. She leaned into him, crying. Jeffrey smoothed her hair, giving Pete a nod. Pete Wayne was normally a cheerful man, but his expression today was one of absolute shock. He barely acknowledged Jeffrey, continuing to stare out the windows lining the front of the restaurant, his lips moving slightly, no sound coming out. A few moments of silence passed, then Tessa sat up. She fumbled with the napkin dispenser until Jeffrey offered his handkerchief. He waited until she had blown her nose to ask,
Where's Sarah?
Tessa folded the handkerchief.
She's still in the bathroom.
I don't know.
Tessa's voice caught.
There was so much blood. She wouldn't let me go in.
He nodded, stroking her hair back off her face. Sarah was very protective of her little sister, and this instinct had transferred to Jeffrey during their marriage. Even after the divorce, Jeffrey still felt in some way that Tessa and the Lintons were his family.
"You okay?"
he asked. She nodded.
"Go ahead. She needs you."
Jeffrey tried not to react to this. If not for the fact that Sarah was the county coroner, he would never see her. It said a lot about their relationship that somebody had to die in order for her to be in the same room with him. Walking to the back of the diner, Jeffrey felt a sense of dread overcome him. He knew that something violent had happened. He knew that Sybil Adams had been killed. Other than that, he had no idea what to expect when he tugged open the door to the women's bathroom. What he saw literally took his breath away. Sarah sat in the middle of the room, Sybil Adams' head in her lap. Blood was everywhere, covering the body, covering Sarah, whose shirt and pants were soaked down the front as if someone had taken a hose and sprayed her. Bloody shoe and handprints marked the floor as if a great struggle had occurred. Jeffrey stood in the doorway, taking all this in, trying to catch his breath.
"Shut the door,"
Sarah whispered. Her hand rested on Sybil's forehead. He did as he was told, walking around the periphery of the room, his mouth opened but nothing would come out. There were the obvious questions to ask, but part of Jeffrey did not want to know the answers. Part of him wanted to take Sarah out of this room, put her in his car, and drive until neither one of them could remember the way this tiny bathroom looked and smelled. There was the taste of violence in the air, morbid and sticky in the back of his throat. He felt dirty just standing there. "She looks like Lena," he finally said, referring to Sybil Adams' twin sister, a detective on his force. "For just a second, I thought." He shook his head, unable to continue.
"Lena's hair is longer."
"Yeah," he said, unable to take his eyes off the victim. Jeffrey had seen a lot of horrible things in his time, but he had never personally known a victim of violent crime. Not that he knew Sybil Adams well, but in a town as small as Hartsdale, everyone was your neighbor. Sarah cleared her throat.
"Did you tell Lena yet?"
Her question fell on him like an anvil. 2 weeks into his job as police chief, he had hired Lena Adams out of the academy in Macon. Those early years, she was like Jeffrey, an outsider. 8 years later, he had promoted her to detective. At 33, she was the youngest detective and only woman on the senior squad. And now her sister had been murdered in their own backyard, little more than 200 yards from the police station. He felt a sense of personal responsibility that was almost suffocating.
"Jeffrey?"
Jeffrey took a deep breath, letting it go slowly.
"She's taking some evidence to Macon," he finally answered. "I called the highway patrol and asked them to bring her back here."
Sarah was looking at him. Her eyes were rimmed with red, but she hadn't been crying. Jeffrey was glad of this one thing because he had never seen Sarah cry. He thought if he saw her crying that something in him would give.
"Did you know she was blind?"
she asked. Jeffrey leaned against the wall. He had somehow forgotten that detail.
"She didn't even see it coming,"
Sarah whispered. She bent her head down, looking at Sybil. As usual, Jeffrey couldn't imagine what Sarah was thinking. He decided to wait for her to talk. Obviously, she needed a few moments to collect her thoughts. He tucked his hands into his pockets, taking in the space. There were two stalls with wooden doors across from a sink that was so old the fixtures for hot and cold were on opposite sides of the basin. Over this was a gold-speckled mirror that was worn through at the edges. All told, the room was not more than 20 feet square. But the tiny black-and-white tiles on the floor made it seem even smaller. The dark blood pooling around the body didn't help matters. Claustrophobia had never been a problem for Jeffrey, but Sarah's silence was like a fourth presence in the room. He looked up at the white ceiling, trying to get some distance. Finally, Sarah spoke. Her voice was stronger, more confident. She was on the toilet when I found her. For lack of anything better to do, Jeffrey took out a small spiral-bound notebook. He grabbed a pen from his breast pocket and started to write as Sarah narrated the events that led up to this moment. Her voice became monotone as she described Sybil's death in clinical detail. Then I asked Tess to bring my cell phone. Sarah stopped speaking and Jeffrey answered her question before she could get it out. "She's okay," he provided. "I called Eddie on the way here."
"Did you tell him what happened?"
Jeffrey tried to smile. Sarah's father was not one of his biggest fans.
"I was lucky he didn't hang up on me."
Sarah did not so much as smile, but her eyes finally met Jeffrey's. There was a softness there that he had not seen in ages.
"I need to do the prelim. Then we can take her to the morgue."
Jeffrey tucked the pad into his coat pocket as Sarah gently slid Sybil's head to the floor. She sat back on her heels, wiping her hands on the back of her pants. She said, "I want to have her cleaned up before Lena sees her."
Jeffrey nodded. "She's at least 2 hours away. That should give us time to process the scene."
He indicated the stall door. The lock was busted off.
"Was the lock that way when you found her?"
"That lock's been that way since I was 7, Sarah said, pointing to her briefcase beside the door. "Hand me a pair of gloves."
Jeffrey opened the case, trying not to touch the blood on the handles. He pulled out a pair of latex gloves from an inside pocket. When he turned around, Sarah was standing at the foot of the body. Her expression had changed, and despite the blood staining the front of her clothes, she seemed to be back in control. Still, he had to ask,
"Are you sure you want to do this? We can call somebody from Atlanta."
Sarah shook her head as she slipped on the gloves with practiced efficiency. "I don't want a stranger touching her." Jeffrey understood what she meant. This was a county matter. County people would take care of her. Sarah tucked her hands into her hips as she walked around the body. He knew she was trying to get some perspective on the scene to take herself out of the equation. Jeffrey found himself studying his ex-wife as she did this. Sarah was a tall woman, an inch shy of 6 feet, with deep green eyes and dark red hair. He was letting his mind wander, remembering how good it felt to be with her, when the sharp tone of her voice brought him back to reality. "Jeffrey!" she snapped, giving him a hard look. He stared back at her, aware that his mind had wandered off to what seemed like a safer place. She held his gaze a second longer, then turned toward the stall. Jeffrey took another pair of gloves out of her briefcase and slipped them on as she talked. "Like I said," Sarah began, "she was on the toilet when I found her. We struggled to the floor. I rolled her on her back." Sarah lifted Sybil's hands, checking under her fingernails. "There's nothing here. I imagine she was taken by surprise, didn't know what was going on until it was too late."
"You think it was quick?"
"Not too quick. Whatever he did, it looks planned to me. The scene was very clean until I came along. She would have bled out on the toilet if I hadn't had to use the restroom." Sarah looked away. "Or maybe not," if I hadn't been late getting here. Jeffrey tried to comfort her.
You can't know that.
She shrugged this off. There's some bruising on her wrists where her arms hit the handicap bars. Also, she opened Sybil's legs slightly. See here on her legs? Jeffrey followed her directions. The skin on the inside of both knees was scratched away.
What's that? He asked.
The toilet seat, she said. The bottom edge is pretty sharp. I imagine she squeezed her legs together as she struggled. You can see some of the skin caught on the seat. Jeffrey glanced at the toilet, then looked back at Sarah.
Think he pushed her back on the toilet, then stabbed her?
Sarah didn't answer him. Instead, she pointed to Sybil's bare torso. The incision isn't deep until the middle of the cross, she explained, pressing into the abdomen, opening up the wound so that he could see. I'd guess it was a double-edged blade. You can see the V shape on either side of the puncture. Sarah easily slipped her index finger inside the wound. The skin made a sucking noise as she did this, and Jeffrey gritted his teeth, looking away. When he turned back, Sarah was giving him a questioning look. She asked, "Are you okay?" He nodded, afraid to open his mouth. She moved her finger around inside the hole in Sybil Adams' chest. Blood seeped out from the wound. "I'd say it's at least a 4-inch blade," she concluded, keeping her eyes on him. "Is this bothering you?" He shook his head, even though the sound was making his stomach turn. Sarah slipped her finger out, continuing, "It was a very sharp blade. There's no hesitation around the incision, so, like I said, he knew what he was doing when he started."
"What was he doing?"
Her tone was very matter-of-fact. "He was carving her stomach. His strokes were very assured, one down, one across, then a thrust into the upper torso. That was the death blow, I would imagine. Cause will probably be exsanguination."
"She bled to death?"
Sarah shrugged. "Best guess right now, yeah. She bled to death. It probably took about 10 minutes. The convulsions were from shock." Jeffrey couldn't suppress the shudder that came. He indicated the wound.
"It's a cross, right?"
Sarah studied the cuts.
"I'd say so. I mean, it can't really be anything else, can it?" "Do you think this is some kind of religious statement?"
"Who can tell with rape?" she said, stopping at the look on his face. "What?"
"She was raped?"
he said, glancing at Sybil Adams, checking for obvious signs of damage. There was no bruising on her thighs or scrapes around the pelvic area.
"Did you find anything?"
Sarah was quiet. Finally, she said, "No. I mean, I don't know."
"What did you find?"
"Nothing." She snapped off her gloves. "Just what I told you. I can finish this back at the morgue."
"I don't."
"I'll call Carlos to come get her," she said, referring to her assistant at the morgue. "Meet me back there when you're finished here, okay?" When he didn't answer, she said, "I don't know about the rape, Jeff, really. It was just a guess." Jeffrey didn't know what to say. One thing he knew about his ex-wife was she did not make guesses in the field.
"Sarah?" he asked then. "Are you all right?"
Sarah gave a mirthless laugh. "Am I all right?" she repeated. "Jesus, Jeffrey, what a stupid question." Sarah walked over to the door, but didn't open it. When she spoke, her words came out clear and succinct.
"You have to find the person who did this," she said. "I know."
"No, Jeffrey." Sarah turned around, giving him a piercing look. "This is a ritualistic attack, not a one-off. Look at her body. Look at the way she was left here." Sarah paused, then continued. "Whoever killed Sybil Adams planned it out carefully. He knew where to find her. He followed her into the bathroom. This is a methodical murder by someone who wants to make a statement. He felt lightheaded as he realized that what she was saying was the truth. He had seen this kind of murder before. He knew exactly what she was talking about. This was not the work of an amateur. Whoever had done this was probably working his way up to something much more dramatic at this very moment. Sarah still did not seem to think he understood. "Do you think he'll stop with one?" Jeffrey did not hesitate this time. "No." Chapter 3. Lena Adams frowned, flashing her headlights at the blue Honda Civic in front of her. The posted speed limit on this particular stretch of Georgia I-20 was 65, but like most rural Georgians, Lena saw the signs as little more than a suggestion for tourists on their way to and from Florida. Case in point, the Civic's tags were from Ohio. "Come on," she groaned, checking her speedometer. She was boxed in by an 18-wheeler on her right, and the Civic driving Yankee in front, who was obviously determined to keep her just above the speed limit. For a second, Lena wished she had taken one of Grant County's cruisers. Not only was it a smoother ride than her Celica, there was the added pleasure of scaring the crap out of speeders. Miraculously, the 18-wheeler slowed, letting the Civic pull over. Lena gave a cheery wave as the driver flipped her off. She hoped he had learned his lesson. Driving through the South was Darwinism at its best. The Celica climbed up to 85 as she sped out of the Macon city limits. Lena took a cassette tape out of its case. Sybil had made her some driving music for the trip back. Lena slid the tape into the radio and smiled when the music started, recognizing the opening to Joan Jett's Bad Reputation. The song had been the sisters' anthem during high school, and they had spent many a night speeding through back roads, singing, "I Don't Give a Damn About My Bad Reputation," at the top of their lungs. Thanks to an errant uncle, the girls were considered trash without the benefit of being particularly poor or, courtesy of their half-Spanish mother, all that white. Running evidence up to the GBI lab in Macon was little more than courier work in the big scheme of things, but Lena was glad to have the assignment. Jeffrey had said she could take the day to cool down, his euphemism for getting her temper under control. Frank Wallace and Lena were butting heads over the same problem that had haunted their partnership from the beginning. At 58 years old, Frank wasn't thrilled to have women on the force, let alone one as a partner. He was constantly leaving Lena out of investigations, while she was constantly trying to force herself back in. Something would have to give. As Frank was 2 years from retirement, Lena knew she would not be the one to bend first. In truth, Frank was not a bad guy. Other than suffering from the kind of crankiness brought on by old age, he seemed to make an effort. On a good day, she could understand that his overbearing attitude came from a deeper place than his ego. He was the kind of man who opened doors for women and took his hat off indoors. Frank was even a mason at the local lodge. He was not the kind of guy who would let his female partner lead an interrogation, let alone take point on a house raid. On a bad day, Lena wanted to lock him in his garage with the car running. Jeffrey was right about the trip cooling her down. Lena made good time to Macon, shaving a full 30 minutes off the drive, courtesy of the Celica's V6. She liked her boss, who was the exact opposite of Frank Wallace. Frank was all gut instinct, while Jeffrey was more cerebral. Jeffrey was also the kind of man who was comfortable around women and did not mind when they voiced their opinions. The fact that he had from day one groomed Lena for her job as detective was not lost on her. Jeffrey did not promote her to meet some county quota or make himself look better than his predecessor. This was Grant County, after all, a town that had not even been on the maps until 50 years ago. Jeffrey had given Lena the job because he respected her work and her mind. The fact that she was a woman had nothing to do with it.
Shit, Lena hissed, catching the flash of blue lights behind her.
She slowed the car, pulling over as the Civic passed her. The Yankee beeped his horn and waved. It was Lena's turn to give the Ohioan a one-finger salute. The Georgia Highway Patrolman took his time getting out of his car. Lena turned to her purse in the back seat, rummaging around for her badge. When she turned back around, she was surprised to see the cop standing just to the rear of her vehicle. His hand was on his weapon, and she kicked herself for not waiting for him to come to the car. He probably thought she was looking for a gun. Lena dropped the badge in her lap and held her hands in the air, offering, "Sorry," out the open window. The cop took a tentative step forward, his square jaw working as he came up to the car. He took off his sunglasses and gave her a close look. "Listen," she said, hands still raised. "I'm on the job." He interrupted her. "Are you Detective Selena Adams?" She lowered her hands, giving the patrolman a questioning look. He was kind of short, but his upper body was muscled in that way short men have of overcompensating for what they lacked in height. His arms were so thick they wouldn't rest flat to his sides. The buttons of his uniform were pulled tight against his chest. "It's Lena," she offered, glancing at his name tag. "Do I know you?"
"No, ma'am," he returned, slipping on his sunglasses. "We got a call from your chief. I'm supposed to escort you back to Grant County."
"I'm sorry?" Lena asked, sure she hadn't heard correctly. "My chief? Jeffrey Tolliver?" He gave a curt nod.
"Yes, ma'am."
Before she could ask him any further questions, he was walking back to his car. Lena waited for the patrolman to pull back onto the road, then started off after him. He sped up quickly, edging up to 90 within minutes. They passed the blue Civic, but Lena did not pay much attention. All she could think was, "What did I do this time?" Chapter 4. Though the Hartsdale Medical Center anchored the end of Main Street, it was not capable of looking nearly as important as its name would imply. Just two stories tall, the small hospital was equipped to do little more than handle whatever scrapes and upset stomachs couldn't wait for doctor's hours. There was a larger hospital about 30 minutes away in Augusta that handled the serious cases. If not for the county morgue being housed in the basement, the medical center would have been torn down to make way for student housing a long time ago. Like the rest of the town, the hospital had been built during the town's upswing in the 1930s. The main floors had been renovated since then, but the morgue was obviously not important to the hospital board. The walls were lined with light blue tile that was so old it was coming back into style. The floors were a mixed check pattern of green and tan linoleum. The ceiling overhead had seen its share of water damage, but most of it had been patched. The equipment was dated but functional. Sarah's office was in the back, separated from the rest of the morgue by a large glass window. She sat behind her desk, looking out the window, trying to collect her thoughts. She concentrated on the white noise of the morgue, the air compressor on the freezer, the swish-swish of the water hose as Carlos washed down the floor. Since they were below ground, the walls of the morgue absorbed rather than deflected the sounds, and Sarah felt oddly comforted by the familiar hums and swishes. The shrill ring of the phone interrupted the silence. "Sarah Linton," she said, expecting Jeffrey. Instead, it was her father.
"Hey, baby."
Sarah smiled, feeling a lightness overcome her at the sound of Eddie Linton's voice. "Hey, Daddy."
I've got a joke for you.
Yeah? She tried to keep her tone light, knowing humor was her father's way of dealing with stress. What's that?
A pediatrician, a lawyer, and a priest were on the Titanic when it started to go down, he began. The pediatrician says, "Save the children." The lawyer says, "Fuck the children." And the priest says, "Do we have time?"
Sarah laughed, more for her father's benefit than anything else. He was quiet, waiting for her to talk. She asked, "How's Tessie?"
"Taking a nap," he reported. "How about you?"
"Oh, I'm okay." Sarah started drawing circles on her desk calendar. She wasn't normally a doodler, but she needed something to do with her hands. Part of her wanted to check her briefcase to see if Tessa had thought to put the postcard in there. Part of her did not want to know where it was. Eddie interrupted her thoughts.
"Mom says you have to come to breakfast tomorrow."
"Yeah?" Sarah asked, drawing squares over the circles. His voice took on a sing-song quality.
"Waffles and grits and toast and bacon." "Hey," Jeffrey said.
She jerked her head up, dropping the pen. "You scared me," she said, then to her father. "Daddy, Jeffrey's here." Eddie Linton made a series of unintelligible noises. In his opinion, there was nothing wrong with Jeffrey Tolliver that a solid brick to the head would not fix. "All right," Sarah said into the phone, giving Jeffrey a tight smile. He was looking at the etched sign on the glass, where her father had slapped a piece of masking tape over the last name Tolliver and written in Linton with a black marker. Since Jeffrey had cheated on Sarah with the only sign maker in town, it was doubtful that the lettering would be more professionally fixed any time soon. "Daddy," Sarah interrupted, "I'll see you in the morning." She hung up the phone before he could get another word in. Jeffrey asked,
"Let me guess, he sends his love?"
Sarah ignored the question, not wanting to get into a personal conversation with Jeffrey. This was how he sucked her back in, making her think that he was a normal person, capable of being honest and supportive, when, in actuality, the minute Jeffrey felt like he was back in Sarah's good graces, he'd probably run for cover. Or under the covers, to be more exact. He said,
"How's Tessa doing?"
"Fine," Sarah said, taking her glasses out of their case. She slid them on, asking, "Where's Lena?" He glanced at the clock on the wall.
"About an hour away. Frank's going to page me when she's 10 minutes out."
Sarah stood, adjusting the waist of her scrubs. She had showered in the hospital lounge, storing her bloodied clothes in an evidence bag in case they were needed for trial. She asked, "Have you thought about what you're going to tell her?" He shook his head no.
"I'm hoping we can get something concrete before I talk to her. Lena's a cop. She's going to want answers."
Sarah leaned over the desk, knocking on the glass. Carlos looked up. "You can go now," she said. Then, explaining to Jeffrey, "He's going to run blood and urine up to the crime lab. They're going to put it through tonight."
"Good."
Sarah sat back in her chair. "Did you get anything from the bathroom?"
"We found her cane and glasses behind the toilet. They were wiped clean."
"What about the stall door?"
"Nothing," he said. "I mean, not nothing, but every woman in town's been in and out of that place. Last count, Matt had over 50 different prints."
He took some Polaroids out of his pocket and tossed them onto the desk. There were close-ups of the body lying on the floor alongside pictures of Sarah's bloody shoe and handprints. Sarah picked up one of these, saying, "I guess it didn't help matters that I contaminated the scene."
"It's not like you had a choice."
She kept her thoughts to herself, putting the pictures in logical sequence.
He repeated her earlier evaluation. Whoever did this knew what he was doing. He knew she would go to the restaurant alone. He knew she couldn't see. He knew the place would be deserted that time.